Hello, and welcome to One-on-One with Robert Doerr. I'm your host, Robert Doerr, and thanks for tuning in today. As president of the American Enterprise Institute, I have the unique privilege of working with America's greatest policy experts. These scholars focus on policy issues in the fields of education, economics, energy, foreign and defense, and so much more. Subscribe to this podcast for exclusive access to in-depth discussions on the most pressing policy issues. Together with my guests, we'll challenge political preconceptions, explore innovative ideas, and create, I hope, a freer and safer world. Okay, welcome everybody. Today our guest is Anthony Mills, Tony Mills. His byline is M. Anthony Mills. What's the M?
Mark.
Mark. So Mark Anthony Mills. Your father's name is Mark.
It is.
So are you a junior?
He's Mark Phillips, so I'm not a junior.
Okay. Well, to me, you are Tony. Can we go by Tony today?
We can, yes, please.
Okay, that's good. He is the director of AEI's Center on Technology, Science, and Energy, which is relatively new. So We're going to talk later in this discussion on what that's like running a center and what's the number of scholars and things like that. But what you've been writing about a lot lately, and in quite prominent places, National Affairs, you wrote a long essay, New York Times, you wrote a long essay, on the loss of confidence that Americans feel in experts. And A lot of it comes as a result of what we went through during the COVID crisis.
Yes.
And so let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, as I look back on what happened there, I'm increasingly coming to the belief that experts at CDC and public health experts especially, maybe because they didn't know what they didn't know, so you give them a little break because there were some uncertainties, but they made a lot of mistakes. And so why isn't this loss of confidence just corrected by, could you get it right?
Yeah, fair enough. I think there's a sort of more direct answer to that question, which I want to get to. But I think it's also important to keep in mind the context. The people have been talking about a crisis of expertise since before COVID. That this really goes back over a decade, arguably more, and really heating up around the beginning of the Trump era. We had lots of discussion in newspapers and magazines and books about the crisis of expertise, the death of expertise, populism as a challenge toward expertise. We had new forms of media and social media that raised questions about information and disinformation. And this is all going on in the lead up to the pandemic. And so in a certain sense, I think the pandemic was sort of dropping a match on fuel. Now, we were already in a place where there was lots of distrust, either overt or kind of bubbling beneath the surface. And COVID came in and just set the place on fire.
Okay, so let's take that. That means that you're right. It was the last straw, or the really flammable straw,
yeah.
and destroyed confidence in experts. But it's kind of you know, the experts said that the Iraq-Afghanistan wars was going to be not so expensive and relatively short and not a lot of casualties. And of course, they'll celebrate democracy and freedom the minute we go marching in.
Right.
And those experts.
Yep.
Were proven to be wrong. The experts said that, let's bring China into the WTO, and this will be great for everybody. Everybody will be great. And then it turned out, well, China wasn't actually such a fair player.
Yep.
So the experts were wrong there. You could say the same thing about, sort of the total, single-minded focus on the general economy and growth, without a sense of, well, there are sometimes losers and we ought to address what's going on in sort of Rust Belt cities. So I guess what I'm saying is that what you mean? That there are a lot of things that the American people were told by elites, you say experts, others say elites, were going to be okay, or was going to work out, or we know best, and they were proven wrong. Is that it?
I think that's basically right. I mean, I think there is a complication here, which is, as you sort of allude to, who are we talking about? There is a tendency in this discussion around COVID, but just more generally, I think, to speak in terms of the expert class, as if there's a sort of model, or the elites, that there's this monolithic group that all thinks the same way, and they're all in the same room making these decisions. And of course, that's not right, right? Yeah. Lots of different kinds of expertise, different kinds of elites that have made different kinds of decisions, some good, some bad. And so it's complicated. But that said, I think that those nuances shouldn't allow us to ignore the reality that something is going on here, that there is a kind of pulling apart of the country around the elites that we associate with the knowledge producing and establishing institutions and those that rely on them. And that that pulling apart was already underway when COVID struck. And then COVID, I think, raises a number of questions, of course, that are unique to the kind of virus that we were dealing with and that are unique to public health and medicine, but on another level are actually quite familiar kinds of problems about uncertainty, making decisions when we are in conditions of uncertainty, weighing what we know against what we what goals we have, what we want to achieve, what sorts of trade-offs are involved in the interventions, and how we think about those compared to the uncertainties and the goals that we want to prioritize. Those are problems that attain, you know, that attach to any kind of policy question, really. It's just that often they're kind of in the background. And with COVID, everything was heightened. And so you had really complex, large-scale problems and questions that were really complex, implicated the entire world. And all of that happening in the context of, if not an overt crisis of expertise, the conditions for such a crisis. And I think it's actually worth staying with the crisis for just a little bit longer, the kind of pre-COVID crisis, because in the scholarly literature prior to 2020, what you would find is a debate about whether there is a crisis. And so you had people on the one hand saying, there's this crisis of expertise and describing it along the lines that you and I just were. And then you have people saying, oh, no, there's actually not really a crisis, making some of the arguments I was making, that there isn't really a monolithic expert class and not everyone's distrustful of everything. And really, and this was an argument that was pushed by a lot of our friends on the center left, what we have is a growing distrust among conservatives of expertise. And that's driven by political ideology. And so really what we have is a sort of conservative crisis of trust. And then I think what COVID did was it really rendered that discussion moot. And whatever you think about that discussion circa 2016, coming out of COVID, it's now undeniable, I think, if you're an honest, fair-minded person, that we have a kind of crisis of expertise that is a part of, distinguishable from, but congruent with a broader crisis of trust in our societal institutions, and that this is not purely a political matter anymore. It's much harder to make that case today.
So I think that's all very interesting and much deeper than sometimes I think about these issues, and that's why we have you. but when I think about, let's just stick with the COVID crisis.
Sure.
Now, when I go back, I think one word comes to mind is fear. Mm-hmm. You know, that you're a public official, you're a governor, you're the president, you're not sure what's going on, and the public health expert comes in and says, well, you know, there's a chance people will die. And that sort of ends all the conversation because you get afraid of, you know, widespread death and sickness. And so they made decisions without recognizing the trade-offs and the downsides. And in looking back, I sort of look at them, you know, the shutdowns, which includes the school closures.
Mm-hmm.
And the masks.
Mm-hmm.
So those three issues, mm-hmm. economic shutdowns, school closures, and masks.
Mm-hmm.
Looking back now, I think there's an impression in the United States, and I'm curious what your view is.
Sure.
Would you say all three were mistakes?
Well, I think, unfortunately, there's not a straightforward answer. If we think about shutdowns, start with that example. Something that is easy to forget now, but was clear at the time, and our colleagues Yuval Levin and Scott Gottlieb wrote about this at the time, people were staying home before policies were put in place to keep people home. There was a stretch of time during the pandemic when policy actually followed people's behavior rather than the reverse. And so now we have this picture of the government coming in saying, everyone stay home. Now, of course, that ultimately did happen. But it's important to keep in mind, too, that we're talking about different levels of government here, that a lot of the decisions that were made that most directly impacted people's lives were actually state, local, municipal, yeah. county level, obviously informed by federal decisions and guidelines, too. But in those early days, people were frightened. Now, we could argue about whether they were right to be frightened and why they were frightened, and that's one set of questions. But pandemics are frightening. If you look at the history of epidemics and pandemics, people tend to respond the same way. Infectious disease outbreaks are frightening in a unique kind of way, and they tend to be destabilizing in the same sorts of ways. And we saw that with COVID. And so when the decisions were made to implement so-called lockdown policies, they were being made in a context in which people weren't going to businesses. People were staying home. They were frightened. That's the first thing I think to keep in mind. Now, that doesn't mean that all of those policies were therefore the correct ones, but in the moment, when you're dealing with uncertainty and the realities on the ground, you're operating a certain decision space, which is quite different from where we're operating now.
But they went on longer, and they were endorsed by governmental advice. I mean, you say in your CDC argument that the CDC kept their guidance in place mm-hmm. longer than they should have. Mm-hmm. And so I do worry. I do think back to my own view was that, you know, I wanted our offices open. I pushed mm-hmm. the envelope as hard as I could against the District of Columbia's rules mm-hmm. on office openings. And I just looking at the health outcomes, have you had a chance to evaluate that in a really comprehensive way, or where should we look for an evaluation of that set of policies involving shutdowns to say, you know, we really did have more downside problems caused by the shutdowns than lives saved by the shutdown?
Yeah. I think it's important to keep in mind what we mean by shutdown and what the goals were. So if you remember in the early days of the pandemic, this was quickly forgotten by, I think, too many policymakers, but also members of the public. The original rationale for the shutdowns was to flatten the curve. The purpose of that was not to keep everyone from getting the disease. It was to prevent our healthcare systems from becoming overwhelmed. Now, you could argue about whether that was the highest priority goal. I think it was a very sensible thing to be worried about. Mm-hmm. But I do think that goal sort of became obscured, and the lockdown sort of became the purpose rather than the means in a lot of people's minds. And I think that that's probably right, that it was a ham-handed response that went on too long. But again, it depends on what we're talking about. So school closures, I think, are a little bit different. And this is something that's interesting about COVID generally. If you look around the globe, policy decisions, there were some commonalities. People were frightened everywhere, right? So a lot of the decisions that were made were similar everywhere. And as I said before, if you spend time reading the history of epidemics, which people like me do, it's a sort of demoralizing thing to do, but you find that actually they have a kind of pattern. And the quarantine, lockdown, that type of response is almost invariably what governments do, because it's a way of saying we're doing something, people are scared. And whether or not it's the best idea, and actually historically, whether or not it's the best public health move has often been debated by experts in moments when there are crises like this. So in that sense, COVID was actually more of the same. But also, while it was happening, you could look at different countries and see, holding constant some of those broad patterns of similarity, some really different decisions that were made about policy. So not all countries had the same policies about school closures, about masking children, about recommending cloth masks versus medical masks. There was variation across the globe, even across Western democracies, on those questions throughout the pandemic. And what that shows, I think, is that what we're talking about here are policy choices, not conclusions of a scientific argument that follow with logical necessity. And when we're making policy choices, we're weighing a number of different factors. And so when it comes to take school closures as a good example, we clearly have trade-offs, right? At the time, there was a lot of uncertainty about, and people forget this now too, about how COVID would impact children, early days. Once we took everyone out of schools, We just didn't really know. Yeah. And we could look to other countries, but the disease patterns in those countries wasn't the same. So we could look at the UK and say, well, we don't see outbreaks among children there, but children were out of school then because it was the summer, right? So like, there are these complexities in the moment that mattered because we were uncertain that now we just kind of brush over. That all said, we also knew that schools are a primary vehicle for social services, especially for low-income families. That's not something that we had to learn. That's something that we knew. Yeah. And so we also knew that taking children out of schools was going to cut them off from social services. That's a pretty big thing to do, right? That's a big decision.
And education.
Not to mention education. But yeah. I'm just like, take that just discrete case.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, yeah, education and all the other socialization factors and the impacts on family, especially parents who had to continue working, who weren't able to stay at home.
Yeah.
So there's this really complex set of trade-offs. And other countries made different decisions. The United States, on average, you know, our school system is highly decentralized. So there's lots of variation in this, but on average, we kept schools closed longer than almost any other country in the world, with just a few exceptions. So that's interesting, right? Was that the right move? I mean, I think we knew enough early, like during the pandemic, to have made a different set of decisions. And there actually were some experts, not enough, not loudly enough, making that case.
Although an argument could be made that position of the United States having the longest school closures of any other country was more a function of the power of the teachers union in public education in America than the trust in experts who were public health experts. I mean, the teachers union played a big role in that. And our scholar here at AEI, Nat Malkus, has shown that extensive closures, those extensive period of closures has led to chronic absenteeism
mm-hmm.
that's continued to this day and a tremendous amount of learning loss.
Learning loss, yeah.
So, I think what you're trying to say is it wasn't only about experts, it was also about politicians and labor unions and the whole way in which we make decisions in the United States. And it can't lay it all on experts, and yet some people have. Some people have now lost faith in experts because they think that was the problem, when maybe it was ourselves. The fault is in ourselves.
I think it's a combination. I don't want to let the experts off the hook here.
Okay.
I mean, I do think if we take, again, stick with schools, I want to make sure I'm getting my facts right so someone could fact check me. In the Netherlands, I believe it was, the government had to weigh the decision about school closures, and they sought expert advice. And the advice that was given by experts was, given the trade-offs involved in closing schools, we recommend against it.
Yeah.
The downsides are they're too high for the potential gains. And interestingly, the government said, understood, but people are frightened. We're going to close them anyway.
Yeah.
And they didn't close them for as long as we did, but they did close them. That's a political decision. In the United States, what we had was experts writing a letter to Science Magazine saying, the science shows that we should close schools. So that's a difference.
That's a difference.
And the role of the expert there is quite different. Now, they could have said, as scientists, we're looking at all this evidence, it's complicated. There are these goals that you as decision makers have to weigh. Here's what we think. And that's the end of the story. It didn't really play out that way.
Yeah.
So I think, yes, on the one hand, we can't just blame everything on the experts. But on the other hand, there are things that we can't blame on the experts.
Okay, so now let's go to one where they, I think you would say, got it right, and yet the loss of confidence undermined their ability to have the outcome that they sought, and that concerns vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
So experts get a lot wrong with COVID. There's some frustration. There's upset. Things didn't turn out the way we thought they were going to turn out. This enormous effort to create a vaccine is successful in the United mm-hmm. States. Vaccines are available. Lots of people take them, and I think the retrospective review is that was a significant net positive.
Yep.
And yet there's still people who are anti-vaccines out of this loss of confidence in experts. Is that right? In other words, the mistakes in other areas have led to a problem in getting people to take vaccines when they should.
Yes. And I would add, I think there were mistakes made in how. So it's interesting to compare vaccines and masks
mm-hmm.
because when the pandemic started, there was a lot of discussion about how vaccines are sort of going to pull us out of the pandemic. Operation Warp Speed, which was the government-led program that allowed the private sector to rapidly develop and then ultimately deploy vaccines, That was the Trump administration success, and it was an amazing success.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of discussion in my world about how vaccines are kind of the exception. Like, we have all these contested questions about masks in schools, but vaccines are pretty uncontroversial. Of course, there have always been people that are vaccine hesitant and skeptical, but that was a marginal aspect of our public life. And then we watch how COVID played out. By the end of the pandemic, up until today, including today, vaccines wound up in the same place, maybe even a worse place, than non-pharmaceutical interventions like masks. And what's interesting is that the science behind both of them is not the same. We can get into the debate over masks, but this is an area where there is genuine expert disagreement about what kinds of face coverings, what kinds of settings, what kind of evidence that was true before COVID, it's true during COVID, it remains true even though the public discourse didn't always reflect
that.
Okay,
so wait, I want to just cut you off. You're saying that people in America are equally skeptical of vaccines as they are of masks, and the science would not lead you to that conclusion.
I don't know if I can quite say that they're similarly skeptical. I don't know if I have like the data to show that.
Okay.
But there's clearly we now have a very serious problem of vaccine hesitancy and skepticism, and some pockets straight up vaccine conspiracy that are hampering public health in domains that actually don't even have to do with COVID. Like, we're seeing less vaccine uptake in other areas of public health.
And that's a problem.
And that's a very big problem.
Yeah, yeah.
But the science of vaccines, this is an area where we have really robust knowledge, and we wound up in the same place. And so if you're looking at policy, you have to ask yourself, how is that the case? You can't explain it by the science. You can't say, well, in one case, we have really good science, so people trust it. The reality is, policy interventions have trade-offs. In public health, they have risks, right? Yeah. And I do think one of the failures around vaccines was, first of all, it was downstream of these other kinds of mistakes and problems of trust, but also on vaccines themselves. I think that we didn't do a good job early thinking about vaccines as policy interventions that have trade-offs and risks, like anything.
Right.
Even the best vaccines do have risks, right? Even if they're
small. So in other words, you're saying we oversold them, or the experts oversold them and didn't acknowledge, you may take this vaccine, you might still get COVID, but it won't be as severe.
Correct.
And we weren't upfront about that.
And some of that was, I think, a lack of knowledge, but I think if we had started from a place of humility, of saying, these have been very well tested, as well, if not better, than other vaccines. So we can say that with confidence. We recommend these vaccines, and we can say with confidence that we're also recommending these. But of course, there are uncertainties about public health interventions.
Yeah.
And then you get into a question about, well, what's the best policy? What does the risk-benefit analysis look like in different contexts? How do you prioritize who gets it? Those are conversations that we had, but we didn't lead with them. We just led with, we have this magical thing that's going to end all of our problems. And of course, it didn't.
Well, just one last thing on this. Why isn't this also related to just, you act like this is all a new development, but the famous book about the war in Vietnam, The Best and the Brightest, is about experts telling the country one thing and finding out that they were completely wrong. And the American people have a long-standing history of questioning authority.
Yeah.
I mean, we just aren't comfortable with top-down, smarty pants telling us how to live our lives. So what's wrong with that?
So I think a healthy amount of skepticism is a good thing, and it's necessary for self-government. It has to be balanced against trust. Societies, especially modern societies, fall apart if we don't have trust, social trust, trust in institutions. But it has to be leavened by skepticism. You need both. And we can talk a little bit more in depth about that. But one thing I will say is, yes, we do have this history of questioning authority, but we also can look at history and see periods of particular kind of crisis of authority. If you look, for example, the late 19th century, the dynamics around elite institutions was surprisingly similar to today. And there were a number of public health crises, epidemics, which I've written about, a yellow fever outbreak in the 1870s, for example, that generated effects, social, economic, and political, that are almost eerily similar to what we saw with COVID. Or fast forward to the post-war decades. By the 1970s, there was profound, I mean, you mentioned Vietnam, there was profound skepticism about the so-called military-industrial complex, the collusion of expertise with state power, with the military. There were concerns about environmental consequences of technological development. And there was a real crisis. And in fact, you can look in the popular but also scholarly literature and see discussions about crisis of trust. The crisis of expertise that we're talking about today, a lot of the origins of that debate are in that period. Then, interestingly, it tended to be the left that was more skeptical.
Oh, yeah.
And today, I think one way to understand the current moment is that, again, it's not purely left or right, but to the extent that we're going to map these politically, it is increasingly the right that evinces the kind of skepticism, distrust of expert institutions, large-scale societal institutions, governmental, private sector. It's more the right now. And that's an interesting shift. So, for example, we know from survey data that people who self-identify as being Republican or conservative tend to be more skeptical of things like GMOs, of vaccines, of the pharmaceutical industry than folks on the left. And that suggests a shift that is interesting. It's not without historical precedent that people have these attitudes. What seems new is that it's now coming primarily from the right.
Okay, so let's turn to another topic in your scope of coverage in the New Center, and that concerns climate and energy.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that leads me to ask you, well, maybe that's because people who tend to be on the right are most unhappy about some of the policies coming out of Washington and the experts regarding climate change that they feel are doing more damage to our economy than is necessary to treat the problem. How do you respond to that?
Unfortunately, I think I'll respond in a similar way. I think the thing with climate is similar to COVID. It's actually, COVID and climate are surprisingly similar at a high enough level of abstraction. The nature of the problem and the risk and the kinds of certainties and uncertainties we have, the trade-offs involved in the policies, the politics around them. But what's, I think, important about climate is that before we really, so we have a new EPA rule about electric vehicles that just came out, right?
Yes.
But long before, that's a, you know, a pretty drastic climate policy. But long before we saw federal action of that kind on climate, we had lots of controversy around climate. And I think it's for similar kinds of reasons. So one of the things that is important about the climate debate is the way in which the issue is described, particularly by the experts. And something that we haven't talked as much about, but maybe should, and this is true for COVID and climate, more than the experts, it's the media institutions that kind of mediate between.
Yeah, we should talk about
experts.
The media's role in this,
yeah.
Because that's a whole big issue, because there are no trusted media outlets either. So
yeah, in our survey, media, no one trusts the media.
Yeah, yeah,
it's,
yeah.
So, the trust is very low, and it's lower than
but
conservatives trust
but
media
stick
less
with
than
climate
government.
And COVID. Yeah. I keep going. I want to hear more about what you're about to say.
Well, so I think one of the aspects that the media issue raises is that when we talk about the experts, often what we're talking about are not ordinary research scientists that are scrambling for grants and doing the best they can in research. You know, most of those people are doing good work in most fields, right? I mean, they're not out there trying to manipulate the world and so forth. There are prominent experts who are sort of representative of expert institutions that have roles in government and international organizations that communicate with the media, that have their own media channels. There are science journalistic, they're science journal, not science journals, but media outlets that are science in their content, that try to popularize scientific knowledge. And then you have the legacy media and the social media, right, that all mediate between the knowledge that we produce and the public and the decision makers. And on climate, there is a history, whether it's articulated explicitly or not, of trying to use a strategy of raising the stakes of the problem to a sufficiently high level that it will motivate people to be worried about it enough to act.
Okay, now that's a good point. In other words, they feel they got to scare us you know, I was going to use a bad term, but they want to scare us.
Yes.
And therefore they hype the data or they manipulate
the data.
Say
things that may not be strictly speaking true.
Okay.
And we saw this during COVID, right? It's not unique to climate, but on problems where the stakes are high. And I think often it's for reasons that are in a way well-intentioned, right? It's like, this is a problem that I'm worried about and people should be worried about, but they're not. And so how do we get people motivated?
But it's just a classic question in any communication field. I do this all the time. The minute you say something that in order to make a point really aggressively that isn't true, and you get called on it, you've harmed your credibility.
100%.
And that, and what you just said is the problem.
Absolutely.
And then again, back to my original point, well, just get the experts to get the facts right instead of trying to hype the fear.
Well, what's interesting about climate is that two things have happened. I think there is a kind of distrust that tends to be, but not only, located on the right. And I think it's related to what we're talking about. It's also related to the fact that frequently preferred policy interventions, again, parallels with COVID here, are described with the same kind of scientific confidence that scientific claims are, right? The science shows that we need to do X, Y, and Z.
Another problem.
And we'd say,
yes,
well, we might actually have a disagreement about policy here,
yeah,
and not disagree about science, but there's a intentional or not conflation of those two, which lends a scientific authority to a policy choice, a policy intervention.
A scientific arrogance, a scientific, and it again harms the credibility of the speaker when you speak with that kind of authority on something you don't really have that authority to speak on.
I think that's right. But what's interesting, what I was going to say about climate, is that you see this sort of distrust dynamic on the right, but on the left, I think increasingly what you see are people that are now really frightened. There's a lot of good data on this, that young people in particular have been sufficiently terrified by climate, but they're not doing anything about climate. It's almost the inverse. There's a sort of fatalism. There's a sense that the world is just going to come to an end, so why should I even bother to do anything? And there does, I think, it may not always be evident in major media outlets and so forth. I think there's a bit of a turn happening now, a recognition that if this is a problem, that we need to think about it as a problem that can be solved. And terrifying people and sometimes being a little bit dishonest about the science and the data and the process isn't helping.
Well,
it's causing a loss of distrust on one side, and it's causing a kind of anxiety and panic and fear on the other side, neither of which is actually constructive. So if your primary goal is to solve the problem, address the problem, this strategy hasn't worked. And I'm cautiously optimistic that there's a change taking place, at least in the policy world, that is recognizing that this strategy has failed.
Well, I really hope that you devote your work and your team's work on the climate side of this to pushing that turn, because I think COVID's behind us and we're not in the middle of a pandemic now, but we have the tensions and problems caused by this climate debate. And we need you and your scholars to point out where there's hype and where there's truth, and make sure we understand the difference, because mm-hmm. it's really a problem. Mm-hmm. And it is leading to, especially on the right, this very severe distrust mm-hmm. of experts on an issue that, I guess you'd have to say that the most reasonable or appropriate thing to say for someone who is examining this policy area is, our climate is changing.
Mm-hmm.
Some activities of human beings may be contributing to that change.
Certainly are, yeah.
And we should see where those changes can be harmful and try to reduce those harms.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that seems a very reasonable thing to say.
Right.
And not that controversial. And yet, what you hear from the climate fearmongers is much worse than that.
Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example.
Or much more dramatic.
Much more
that.
Dramatic. I'll give you an example. There is a relatively new branch of climate science, of climate attribution, that is often reported in the media now. So you have a storm, you'll have a major storm or a hurricane or something, and then there'll be discussion about, well, was this caused by climate change? 10 years ago or so, the coverage of those issues tended to be relatively balanced, because the reality is it's very difficult to attribute those sorts of things to climate. And there are lots of questions about storm intensity versus storm frequency that are actually complicated, and they don't naturally fit into the alarmist narrative that some folks would like to push. And so what's increasingly happened is scientists and media outlets will more or less say, this storm is caused by climate, right? As if we have the kind of confidence to make that attribution. And in fact, we usually don't. We're doing an event in April with Ted Nordhaus of the Breakthrough Institute, who has a new essay on this issue in the New Atlantis. Roger Pelkey, our colleague, part of the center, and Ted, who are friends and whose work is very complementary, are going to do an event on this issue in April. And it's a good case study in how the alarmism can really be not just misrepresent the science, but can be counter to thinking about practical policy interventions that could help.
Yes.
And so that's just one example.
Well, I think that's an important topic. Now, we have limited time. These conversations can't go on too long. I would with you go on forever. And so I'm going to not bring up artificial intelligence, because it's a complicated subject, and you have written really well on a way to approach it from the federal level that harkens to one of our other colleagues, mm-hmm. Leon Cass's mm-hmm. work. Mm-hmm. And I urge our listeners to look at that writing, because it's very good. But I'd like to finish our conversation. If you have something to say about that, go ahead and say it. But I also want you to talk a little bit about your goals for a center. As a head of a center at AEI, you know your way around the think tank world. You know your way around the public policy world. What are you trying to accomplish? What is this thing?
My answer might ultimately come back around to the AI point, actually.
Okay.
Historically, AEI has been a leader in science and technology policy. If you look, especially in the 90s, there was sort of a golden age of science policy, maybe 80s and 90s. In AEI, in our colleagues next door, Brookings, did a lot of really important work in science policy in particular. A lot of that was done was led by our colleague Claude Barfield, who still does excellent work.
Yes, he does.
Of course, AEI has continued to do lots of good work in tech policy and in energy. But part of my sort of idiosyncratic goal is to reclaim a little bit of that heritage institutionally, that I think AEI really ought to be the premier public policy think tank on this range of issues, science, technology, and energy policy, which are not all the same, but obviously interrelated. And for me, as an expert in science policy in particular, I think has gotten short shrift. It's interesting because science, one might think, matters more today than ever, but it's not, as a policy area, something that has received the kind of attention that it did historically. I have my theories about why that is that maybe we could get into, but I think it's more or less descriptively true. And it's starting to change, and you're starting to see especially a new generation of small think tanks and organizations kind of get into the game. And this is a place where AEI can and should have really big impact. And so that's part of my kind of personal
goal. And let me just ask about that impact, because are you saying that I want to be writing and publishing material that frees up and funds and supports, or finds funding for, or supports funding for, scientific discovery in all kinds of venues, private sector, public sector, universities? Is that what you're saying? You just want more discovery?
That's a part of it. But it's also, thinking about science policy broadly, you have the question of how do we have policies that facilitate scientific discovery and progress? We also have questions about how we make decisions about science, who controls, funds, supports different aspects of it. There are certain areas of science we could talk about, the life sciences, where we have questions of biosecurity and biosafety that call for a certain mode of governance that's going to be very different than what you would
want. And that may come
astronomy.
Into play in artificial intelligence.
Correct. Exactly. And then you have questions about how we use science to make policy decisions. And so if you think about science policy broadly, it encompasses a wide range of things. A lot of what we've been talking about just for the past 30 minutes or so falls under what I would call science policy.
Yes.
One aspect of it. And the other aspect is thinking about innovation and technological policy as well. And so we, you know, we have a tech policy team here at AEI that's done great work and will continue to do great work. But we, my goal is to sort of build on that to do more in this broader range of policy areas. And I guess the broader institutional goal is I think that there is a gap that we are filling and can fill more. And that is that whether it's science or technology or energy, I think increasingly we're having a kind of monolithic debate where on the one side, there are familiar left of center, left wing views about science and technology. You know, we were talking earlier about the Vietnam era and the sort of neo-romantic critique of technology, and that's still a prevalent element in our public life. But now what we're seeing is a version of that on the right. And so a lot of the debates around technology and science are right and left wing versions of kind of pessimistic views of science and technology. And then you sometimes will find a kind of bright and sunny, optimistic libertarian counterweight. What I would like to add to this is a properly, if I could put it this way, conservative view of science and technology, one that recognizes both science and technology as aspects of our human nature, our desire to know and to discover, and also our desire to manipulate the world around us to make it better, but that at the same time, technological change carries risks and downsides, and that as conservatives, I think we can be particularly good at thinking about those sorts of questions without throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And an important aspect of this, which gets to the AI point, is what are our goals, right? If we think of technology as our capacity to optimize, to do things more efficiently, that's obviously very helpful, right? But it depends on what we're optimizing for. You know, we could do bad things really efficiently and effectively, right? Or we could do good things more efficiently and effectively. And I think conservatives can draw on a rich intellectual moral tradition for thinking about the goals of human freedom and flourishing and how technology and science can be in service of those in a way that holds the good and the bad in a kind of productive tension, rather than running to the kind of doom and gloom that is characteristic of a lot of our public discourse around AI, for example, or an uncritical optimism that doesn't recognize that sometimes there are trade-offs and tensions. Life could be tragic.
And that's a really great way to put it, Tony. I really like that because it is this damaging skepticism and negativity that is characteristic on both the right and the left that is not helpful. And yet there, you point out, and you don't spend as much time describing it, but there's this other sort of libertarian answer, which isn't right either.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're trying to do is find that prudent middle course that gets the benefits of science and technology, but also recognizes that we have to be careful. And there are mm-hmm. issues that we have to look at that are humanistic and bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And the libertarians miss that. And of course, the skeptics don't even get in the door.
And I would add, and this sort of actually links back to the earlier part of our conversation, and it's something that libertarians and I actually think center left colleagues sometimes have in common, which is a tendency to treat all problems as if they just were technological or technical problems. That if we just have more science and technology, we can solve all of these problems. And in fact, many of the most important problems aren't like that. They're more complicated. They involve human nature. They involve social, cultural components, which are difficult and sometimes not even solvable. Some problems aren't really problems. They're conditions.
I think as
a conservative, we can articulate that in a way that is sort of precluded by the worldviews that are dominating the discourse around science and technology today.
All right. Well, with that, Tony Mills, thanks for being here. See you next time.